This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ethan Besser-Frederick, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Diana Arbiza about her new book, The Spirit of Hispanism, Commerce, Culture, and Identity Across the Atlantic, 1875 to 1936. Diana, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ethan. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm very excited to talk to you about the book, but before we start talking about your book, Diana, I was wondering if you could begin the interview by just telling us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Antwerp in Belgium. I moved here just a few years ago because previously I worked and studied in the U.S., where I finished my master and my PhD in Hispanic Studies at the University of Illinois. Before that, I should clarify that I'm not American. I was born and raised in the Basque Country. And I say that because maybe growing there sparked my interest in the construction of nationalism, which is definitely an interest that is behind the work I have been doing and that I'm currently doing about Spanish cultural production and the cultural politics regarding Spain's former colonies.
Well, that transitions really nicely into my next question, which is, how did you come to write this book in particular?
This book, I suppose, originally emerged in great part because I had kind of an eye-opening experience when I moved to the States. And as a graduate student, I kind of came to realize that I knew very little about Latin America, that I had basically received very little education about Latin American history or literature or politics, despite the fact that Latin America is frequently invoked in Spanish public and political discourse. So I was intrigued about post-colonial relations very soon. And originally, I planned on analyzing travel narratives by Latin Americans visiting Spain. And in compiling my corpus, I came across with books written by Latin American authors who had visited Spain during the centennial of 1892. And in some of those texts, I found authors that were talking of common transatlantic Hispanic identity. This was the corpus finally of my dissertation. But writing the dissertation was a very humbling experience because I was studying authors from several countries, and I came to realize that their Hispanic discourse was not only ideologically conditioned, but also quite determined by their national context. So I felt that to expand my dissertation into a book all those directions were too many to cover in my book, and I decided to focus on Peninsular Hispanism. I naturally tried to integrate the Latin American contributions and voices that were crucial for the development of Hispanism in Spain. But I decided to concentrate on how Hispanism acted in Spain as a kind of neo-imperialistic movement, as a restitution for Spain's minor role in global politics. And in particularly, reading the literature that has been done on Hispanism, I was very interested about showing that it was not only imperial nostalgia, that it was not only a movement about recovering symbolic authority, but that it was a movement with economic interest, and that those economic interests were not in isolation, but were mutually influencing cultural and economic discourses. So that's basically it. Long explanation.
I really like what that intellectual genealogy reveals about Hispanism, which claims to speak to and speak about an enormous cultural heritage shared by an enormous number of people. But you're saying that the actual diversity within that movement is so immense that it's almost difficult to write about it in a singular sense, which is something you also bring up in this book.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote in this book the enormous diversity within Peninsular Hispanism. I sometimes felt, there are like fine lines, because you have, on the one hand, you need to homogenize and compartmentalize to start your analysis. And I was using some categories that other scholar Sepúlveda Muñoz, building on Frederick Pike, had developed, talking about the conservative, the liberal, and then the Hispanidad. But still, within those categories, there is enormous variation, and there is also cross-fertilization. There are like, reverberations of some authors, who are conservative, and you would expect that the liberal conservatives would never have said what the conservatives were arguing, and you find some connections. So there is enormous variation and at the same time continuities. And then when you expand it and you analyze, the phenomenon of Hispanism in Colombia or the Hispanism in Peru, they have, complete different variations as well. So already it was quite challenging to try to make justice to the diversity of Peninsular Hispanism.
So your book traces the history of Hispanismo and its affiliated commercial projects in Spain from 1875 to 1936. Could you briefly introduce our listeners first to Spain during this time period? I know that's a tricky question because there's a lot going on in Spain between 1875 and 1936. And also why you set this time period for the parameters of your book.
There is a tendency to conceive Hispanism as a movement that was an aftermath of 1898. And it is true that the colonial loss of 98 had a significant impact in Hispanism and contributed to its growth. But I also wanted to underscore that the Hispanic discourse and the transatlantic rapprochement had already been developing for several decades, that you really have to go back in history. One of the early books on the subject by Mark Van Aken indeed studied an earlier stage of the movement, analyzing transatlantic relations between the 1830s and the 1860s. So, it was a process in development for quite a long time. But I chose 1875 because in Spain is the beginning of the Bourbon Restoration, La Restauración Borbónica. Well, technically it starts in December of 1874, but practically in 1875. And to me, this was a period that paved the way for the interrelation between culture and economics. In Hispanism, the Restoration was a period that was of extreme political corruption, but on the other hand, of great economic modernization. And during this period, entrepreneurs, economists, and politicians became more aware that cultural bonds could be capitalized to recover the Latin American markets. And also during this period, during the Restoration, there are like some schools of economic thought that appear in Spain that were going to match quite well with the goals of cultural Hispanism, and foster the initial union of cultural and economic interest among some groups. And another third aspect of, you know, the interesting part of these decades of the Restoration and why my project is also that in the last decades of the 19th century, you have the consolidation of a professional literary field, the growth of the publishing industry, but also of the piracy, and Spanish authors became much more interested in strengthening the bonds with Latin America, signing treaties of intellectual property, published in American newspapers. I also, you know, consider that we had to decentralize 1898. For me, it was very important the 1892. I mentioned before that during my dissertation, I had studied specifically the celebrations of the fourth centennial of the Spanish colonization of the Americas, 1892. And these the celebrations in Spain were the first occasion that gathered many Latin Americans and Spanish intellectuals after the independence of continental Latin America. And as you can imagine, around the commemorations, there was like, you know, identitarian discourses were thriving. So we have a solid production of Hispanic discourses around 1892, many by Latin American Creoles who visited Spain at that time, and here we also have a beginning of what I call the Spanish cannibalization of Latin American cultural production. Latin American Creoles start talking as well about the great Hispanic family, and Spanish authors found, you know, applauded this discourse, found it very appealing because it was very convenient for them, and we'll see then traces of that in the early 20th century, when Spanish intellectuals reappropriate Rodó and Rubén Darío, etc. And then in the first decades of the 20th century, what we find is a history of ups and downs in Hispanism. There is like some discourses that are repeated over and over again, proposals that never get materialized, and some Hispanists even have a feeling of bitter deja vu. There are several reasons for this, but I suggest that one important reason for this is the lack of cohesion of the movement and the tensions that will slowly emerge between the cultural and the economic interest around the movement. And then I chose to finish in 1936 because obviously with the Spanish Civil War and the dictatorship, the cultural and economic life in Spain changed, and also I had the impression that the derivation of La Hispanidad during the early Francoism was the divergent phenomenon from what I studied. Although this is basically another like book project, so it felt to me that it was like a natural end. Although I do think, and it's something that I pointed in the introduction and epilogue, that we find reverberations of the Hispanic discourse even in contemporary Spain.
I completely agree with 1936 as an endpoint, and one of your chapters later on will deal very nicely with that transition from the time period you're looking at to sort of the beginnings of Francoist Hispanidad. But before we get there, I want to start with your introduction, where you make the argument that many Spanish Hispanists sought to form deeper commercial ties with Spanish America, but that the contradictions within the movement, as well as the political and economic challenges in Spain, very much limited this project. First, though, we should probably define what you mean by Hispanism, or what Hispanism is, especially if that's a new term for some of our listeners. So could you briefly introduce us to what is Hispanismo and explain why you believe it both saw it and also sort of struggled with this commercial project?
Well, this is kind of a nightmare question, I think, for everybody who studies Hispanism. I frequently say that Hispanism is a little bit like a floating signifier, because the movement subatomized so much, so many groups, and each group produced certain definitions of Hispanic identity, of what Hispanism was about. Frederick Pike, who wrote one of the foundational works on the subject of Hispanism, said that due to this difficulty, it is maybe better to talk to define or to describe Hispanism as the belief that Spanish and Latin Americans shared a common identity and based on the colonial past. And I frequently refer to this definition, right? The belief of the shared common identity. And then when you go to the text, you see that generally Hispanist authors argue that those traits that, you know, the Hispanic had in common were language, cultural values. Some even talk of blood and race, which was also understood in various ways. And something that really intrigued me was that many Hispanists also insisted that one of the common traits was having a common anti-materialistic worldview that they oppose the supposedly materialistic ethos or character of the Anglo-Saxon. So I was fascinated with, you know, this insistence, this description of the Hispanic as anti-materialistic, morally superior to, you know, the interest in commerce that Anglo-Saxons displayed. Because at the same time, I was quite early on perceiving that there was like a very clear economic aspect to this movement and very, very obvious economic interest around them. So then I tried to focus precisely on how from the emergence there was those interests were hand in hand, and then little by little, as the Hispanic identity was the idea of a Hispanic identity was becoming consolidated, and this narrative grew and grew and grew and was more appropriated by some of the subgroups of the movement, became a point of friction and made more challenging precisely the coexistence of these different interests in the movement.
You outline these wonderful contradictions contradictions is probably the best word for it, you know, this mixture of commercialism and idealism, and then simultaneously the fact that Spaniards often seem to think that Hispanism is centered in the peninsula, even though, like you've already said, this is an idea they're very much picking up from Latin Americans. So there's some wonderful dissection of Hispanism that you do in the introduction, but I want to zone in on one particular line that I've just been thinking about nonstop since I've read it. On page 8 in the introduction, you make a wonderful observation about the role that Hispanism played for Spaniards. You write, quote, "Hispanism emerged as a restitution for the loss of continental Spanish America and as an anticipated reparation for what was foreseen at the time as an imminent loss of the remaining colonies in America and Asia." And I'm struck at this sort of post-colonial nostalgia and that it could develop before even the remaining colonies were lost, that this feeling preceded the actual disaster of 1898. So I'm definitely going to borrow this term of anticipated reparation as an analytic to describe imperial behavior and imaginations and nostalgia. Could you talk a little bit about this dynamic of feeling nostalgic for an imperial past before the empire's even done?
Thank you, Ethan. I think that partly is that once again, we have this date, 98, casting a shadow over everything. But of course, indeed, Spain had been struggling to maintain control in the Caribbean, in the Philippines, for at least a couple of decades before 1898. So the loss of these regions was not that surprising, and especially if we consider, Spain progressively losing colonies, it has been a process in development. So we have that. On the other hand, we have in the late 1850s and 1860s, Leopold O'Donnell had led a campaign of imperial prestige and had tried to recover even some territories in Latin America with quite disastrous consequences. So I think that the war with Chile and Peru over the Chincha Islands, or the intervention in Mexico with France, made quite clear for some Spaniards that the time for territorial and political domination of continental Latin America was over. And combined with the political upheaval in what were the remaining colonies in America and the Pacific, created that sense of anticipation and ways trying to reconceptualize how the relationship will have to be to maintain certain cultural authority and recover them, at least commercially. I think that the coincidence also of several circumstances during Restoration Spain, for me, make that Spain, although paradoxically at the time was considered a minor and outdated colonial power, on the other hand, would attempt with Hispanism to create what we could call today a form of cultural and economic neo-imperialism.
You begin this conversation of Hispanism in your first chapter, Hispanism as Vindication, Spain as the Other in the Age of Commerce, in which you historicize the myth that Spaniards are and always have been bad at business. And then you analyze how Spaniards began rejecting or reevaluating or repurposing this myth to invent new notions of Spanish national character. Could you talk a little bit about this history and of this myth that Spaniards are bad at business, and how Spaniards responded to it in the time period you studied?
Yeah. Well, as I think I've already said, since I began studying Hispanism, I was always fascinated with the relationship between culture and economics, the insistence on the anti-materialistic character of the Hispanic. And then simultaneously, I'm working on this and I'm reading contemporary news about the economic crisis that followed 2008, and some press began to use the horrible acronym of PIGS to talk about Southern European countries and say things, say that these countries PIGS, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, and say that this country is like a culture of effort and work ethic that lack entrepreneurial spirit. So I was kind of fascinated and horrified because it really sounded a lot like some things that I was reading. So I became interested in tracing the origins of these stereotypes, as I expected that this myth of Hispanic anti-materialism could be a compensatory narrative or a counter-narrative to this other construction. So in this chapter, what I wanted was to trace depiction, the construction of Spain in Western modernity as an other inadequate for the age of commerce, and how this image was explained by different disciplines and school of thought, from classical liberalism to sociology with Weber later in the 19th century, and this also expanded to the imagination of Spanish colonialism, because Spain was often described as a non-modern, non-commercial model of colonialism. So then I suggest that fueled by these portraits, around the 1870s, Spanish intellectuals are going to reinterpret this image and embrace this image and claim that Spanish colonialism was actually morally superior to commercial models, which, for these authors are exemplified by the British or the Dutch colonialism. And eventually, this redefinition of Spanish colonialism, I argue, would also contribute to the development of the notion of Hispanic idealism.
This notion of Hispanic idealism connects very nicely into your second chapter called The Emergence of Hispanic Idealism, 1892 to 1900, and it follows what you just described as Hispanic idealism. Could you tell us a little bit more about what is Hispanic idealism and then what its trajectory was at the end of the 19th century?
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually borrow the term from a discourse that the Uruguayan poet Juan Zorrilla de San Martín gave in Spain when he was attending the 1892 celebrations. And of course, this notion did not come from a vacuum, as I have explained, but I think that he gave a very powerful discourse, a term that was, really, really praised by Spanish press, by Spanish intellectuals. Zorrilla de San Martín was proposing that, Spanish and Latin Americans served, as I have mentioned, a worldview that distinguished them from, other parts of the world, particularly Anglo-Saxons, in the sense that they had an idealistic superior in that sense worldview than the Anglo-Saxons, who were close to materialism. It was also a way to position themselves as, we are not, it's not that we are not modern as they attacked us, but we chose to be different. What was mind-blowing for me is that he was giving this talk a few streets away from where there were stores that had all this memorabilia around the centennial of 1892, with many Spanish authors claiming for treaties on intellectual property, with congresses talking about commercial arrangements. So it is a powerful narrative that intellectuals insisted on, while at the same time we have material reality around them that contradicted quite clearly the discourse. Yet it was, basically they were trying to make what had been described as a liability, they were trying to make it a virtue, and it really resonated. Then by the 1900, José Rodó published Ariel, and Ariel really becomes one of the most important works for Peninsular Hispanism. They also reinterpret the work. José Rodó is not, as a straightforward Hispanist as many Spanish intellectuals try to depict him. But it is a work that goes in that line of creating an opposition against Anglo-Saxons and describing them as closer to, a materialistic view. It will be a powerful image and notion that would resonate for decades.
Well, as much as Hispanic idealism was a powerful image, this chapter is also full of powerful images, one of which forms the cover of the book. And I have to bring this up, this proposed monument to discovery that was supposed to appear at the 1892 commemoration of the discovery of the Americas. Could you describe this project, this massive globe building that was supposed to be built in Chicago. Could you describe this project a little bit and why it never came to fruition? Mm-hmm.
This monument, which is like a huge globe with a Spanish caravel on top, was designed for the celebrations of 1898 by a Basque engineer, Alberto de Palacio, who was a student of Eiffel, and he was quite innovative, and he was responsible of many important buildings in late 19th century Spain, very famous for very famous for a transporter bridge very close to my hometown, the first one of its kind, El Puente Colgante. So anyway, he was chosen precisely because he embodied someone who could both represent modernity and glorify the Spanish colonialism in America. And there was some talk about making this building first for the celebrations in Spain, but very soon it was disregarded because it was impossible because of the budget. There were like many, many issues around the lack of budget around the centennials of 1892 in Spain. Then there was some conversation about of making this building to represent Spain in the Chicago exhibition of 1893. Which was also an exhibition tied to the commemoration of the so-called discovery of America, and the Chicago celebrations were a rival celebration for the Spanish centennial. So some imagine that this building could precisely, represent Spain with glory, but once again, no budget. I don't remember the details. I think I didn't include them in the book at the end, but the size of the monument was grotesque, was huge. And to me, the story was fascinating, and I suggested as the book cover, because for me, it was very symbolic of the contrast between the aspirations that many Hispanics had in the movement and then how the movement evolved and how little little they accomplished in terms of, material outcomes.
I think it was a perfect choice for a book cover because I just love that both the designer for this and some of the original project planners for this building had to be told that it couldn't be done, that somehow they thought it could have been done, and it was a surprise mm-hmm. to them, which I think tells you a lot about Hispanism in Spain mm-hmm. at the time. Your third chapter, moving on, is called Complicated Harmonies, Economic and Cultural Initiatives in Progressive Hispanism. And it looks at a rather unique iteration of Hispanism. When I think of Hispanism, especially in the Mexican context where I look at it, I tend to associate it only with conservative mm-hmm. politics. And so it was interesting here to look at progressives in Spain using Hispanism as a discourse and as a political project, especially because for them, commercialism was not really a dirty word per se, in the same way it was for some other Hispanist discourses that existed. Could you tell us a little bit about these progressive Hispanists? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I borrow the terms liberal and progressive. Pike especially used liberals, and then Sepúlveda Muñoz used progressive or liberal branch of Hispanism. And indeed, it is important to distinguish within the many groups that finally composed this movement. But you had there is definitely a big distinction between the conservative and the liberals, while at the same time they have many points in common, of course. But anyway, in this chapter, I was very interested particularly in this group of the progressive Hispanism. I saw that there was at the beginning very harmonious interrelation of culture and economics, and then I wanted to trace how it started so harmonious and then how it progressively dissolved. So some of the most important figures of this branch were liberal intellectuals such as Rafael Altamira, Rafael Mario de Labra, Posadas, Piernas Hurtado. Many intellectuals who were close to the Krausist movement. And this relation with the Krausist is commonly known, but much less studied and less well known is the approach to economics derived by Krausism, which was a philosophical school. And then it was quite revealing to know about this school of economics that came from Krausism, because I understood how this vision of economics had influenced these Hispanists and had led them to see that cultural and economics were interrelated spheres, and that the cultural and commercial interest in Hispanism could go hand in hand. I explore how Altamira was pretty optimistic about this relationship in the early 20th century. He was in touch with entrepreneurs and other groups, and other Hispanist groups that were much more focused on commercial relations. But progressively, this vision of harmonizing agendas became much more complicated because, some groups accused Altamira of practicing a lyrical Hispanism with no results. Then he was also accused of practicing economic neo-imperialism, then of not being different enough from a conservative reactionary branch. So eventually, there were like different figures. I studied Ruiz de Lariaga, an economist who was very close to Altamira and wrote extensively about the Hispanist bond. But progressively, this liberal Hispanism kind of diluted, became very diluted. Sepúlveda Muñoz rightly argues that is in part because of the prominence that the ultra-reactionary derivation of Hispanism, La Hispanidad, would acquire in the 1930s, and also because Primo de Rivera would cannibalize part of the agenda of the liberal Hispanists. But I also think that it is very important to take into account how that interrelationship between culture and economics was quite essential and, quite intrinsic to how liberal Hispanists had imagined the movement at the beginning, and then it became practically impossible to sustain their vision like that.
Your fourth chapter is a shift in that you move to the sort of Hispanidad that starts to overtake Hispanismo, like you just described. But it's also a shift in that you're following a single person. Your fourth chapter is called Ramiro de Maeztu and the Search for a Hispanic Economic Ideology. And you study this titular character, de Maeztu's thinking over time as he shifts everything from a sort of liberal to a sort of socialist until he becomes very associated with what eventually we would call Francoism. Could you tell us a little bit about Maeztu and his search for a Hispanic alternative to capitalism?
Mm-hmm. So you are right that in the other chapters I present multiple authors, but in this one I focus on just Maeztu. I did it not only because Maeztu is by far the most important figure of La Hispanidad, but I also found that, unlike other authors who talk about La Hispanidad, in the work of Defensa de la Hispanidad by Maeztu, there was like an underlying latent interest in economics that it was a very personal preoccupation of Maeztu. And of course, I was interested in that relationship, but that was the subject of the whole project. I wanted to see that, and I didn't see it in other authors as clearly, but in Maestu, for me, was very latent. Maestu was a very mercurial character who definitely underwent extreme changes, as you have mentioned, from socialism to, you know, becoming an economic liberal. Then he abhorred this in defensa de la Hispanidad. So he underwent radical changes. But what I argue in my book is that I think that there is an interest in providing an economic guide to the Hispanic nations, and this obsession with providing this economic guide is kind of a thread that joins all his writings. So normally, when Maestu is associated with Hispanism, he is generally associated with it because of his work about La Hispanidad in the 1930s. But he wrote many, many articles in the 1920s that should be fully considered part of his Hispanist production, even though his discourse is completely different from his arguments about La Hispanidad. And in those articles in the 1920s, he's talking about the Hispanic nation. So he's considering them as a cultural unity, and he's trying to provide an economic ethos for them. So then in Defensa in the 30s, he changed his liberal views. But I think that some of the same concerns are there. The opposition with the Anglo-Saxon and the depiction of them as, you know, as having a different economic worldview are there. And I think he was timidly trying to provide another economic path, even though he did not have time to fully develop it. But I think he's playing with the idea of La Hispanidad and La Hispanidad as a third path, and infusing commerce with the spirit of Trento. So I think he, you know, the economic aspect was not totally away from his mind, and he was working on it.
One of many possible third paths that people were seeking out in that time period.
Exactly.
Your fifth and final chapter, Commercial Hispanism, Marketing Spiritual Capital, follows what you call these Hispanists from the periphery, especially in Bilbao and Barcelona. And this chapter covers several topics from their views on commerce, from publishing rights and the role of regionalism and even Spanish immigration to the New World. So would you be willing to introduce Hispanism on the peripheries of Spain and how it developed in these areas in difference from one another and from difference to the more Castilian sort of Hispanisms that you've been talking so far?
Barcelona and Bilbao were two very important economic centers in the late 19th century, the two great economic centers. And for different reasons, actually for quite opposite reasons, were quite involved in strengthening links with Latin America after 1898. For Catalonia, the colonial loss affected them quite negatively. So the entrepreneurial society was really trying to reestablish as many links as possible and as fast as possible. And for the Basque, it was the opposite. They received many Indianos and a great influx of repatriated capital after the colonial loss. And that capital, they invested it in new banks and new companies that many of these Indianos were directing. And because they had just, you know, returned from decades in America, they were naturally looking and thinking about, you know, now making making business now with the Latin American countries. So for two different reasons, emerged a natural interest in developing a commercial type of rapprochement with Latin American nations in those two regions. What is very interesting is that in these two areas, you find that in the late 19th century there is like this rival nationalism, and how consistently they are kept a little bit outside of the imagination of Spanish national identity, which is generally depicted as quite focused. Now, the center of Spanish nationalism is Castile, and Barcelona and Bilbao became, you know, become peripheries, and some like Rubén Darío, I actually quote Rubén Darío at the beginning of this chapter, even argues, okay, Spain cannot forget that its center is Castile, and while it's good to have, you know, Barcelona and Bilbao as economic motors. So interestingly, the fact that they were like economically, quite modern, was also a part that differentiated them from the imagination of Spanish national identity centered around Castilian identity. So I analyzed how the Hispanist movement developed in these two regions, quite focused on creating these commercial networks, although the Hispanist of Catalonia and the Basque Country had initially many links with some of the liberal Hispanists that I studied in Chapter 3. They actually were in conversation with groups in Madrid, but rivalries with the groups in Madrid soon emerged, and basically Catalonians failed in becoming like kind of the leaders of the Hispanist movement within Spain. Yet they continued, especially Catalonians, very active relationship with Latin America, a very successful entrance into the Latin American market, and so I study first of all how they positioned themselves, how they justified their activities, which type of language they were using, which schools of political economy were invoking to legitimize their Hispanist vision in front of these other groups, and I chose to focus on two phenomena that I found quite fascinating: all the discourse and also the all the discourse about the book commerce that that was developing at the time period. The book commerce was for commercial Hispanists it was quite central. Because on the one hand, there was like enormous business to make. And secondly, it was also a type of commerce that perfectly legitimized their intervention, because the book was seen as a means to keep on strengthening cultural bonds and keep on nurturing that relationship. So actually Catalonians were very successful with their book industry and their book commerce. The Basque never managed to develop as such. And then as I wanted to offer like the counter a counter example of a topic that was quite central in the discourses of these Hispanists, but unlike the book, was quite controversial for them, which was the emigration. For commercial Hispanists, immigration was a phenomenon that they saw quite positively. They included quite often reviews of immigrants in these areas in their publications because they believe that having a solid influx of immigrants in Latin America could help to strengthen their markets there, that those immigrants were going to consume and also advertise the Spanish products in the Latin American republics. However, the Spanish press and the Spanish public opinion was quite divided around the massive Spanish immigration that moved to Latin America in from the 1880s to the First World War. So there were some people that considered that immigration to Latin America was a drain, that Spain needed to concentrate its efforts within Spain. And then it was quite paradoxical that that they were talking about the social regeneration in a figure that normally, in a figure, the immigrants that normally had very obvious economic interest when they were emigrating. So it was, unlike the book, which was, the perfect commodity to invoke to justify their action. Immigration became a pretty thorny question for commercial Hispanists.
I very much enjoyed reading this last section as a person who looks at it in Latin American history, because there's a similar sort of duality where some Latin American governments and citizens think, oh, there's a great influx of capital or of racial purification, of whitening of the country. And there are others that are afraid of the political consequences of what they perceive as colonial foreigners. So it's interesting to see this also from the Spanish perspective. And I'm sure people who study Latin America during this time period would appreciate seeing how it was viewed back in the peninsula as well.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic because it was really a massive immigration.
So your book ends with a very interesting afterword, which you've already hinted at, where you connect this to politics and economics and discourse in Spain in the last 50 years, especially in relation to the Barcelona Olympics and other trade agreements. But I'll leave that right now as a treat for the readers, but I do recommend people read that afterward. It's very interesting. Instead, I would love to hear from you what you're either working on now or plan to work on next.
My current project is about Spanish cultural politics and economic interest in Africa from the second half of the 19th century to the first half of the 20th century. I imagine that this sounds very distant from this book, from the spirit of Hispanism, but I actually began thinking about it because I kept on finding references about Africa when I was researching for this book. So when I was researching for the spirit, I mean, I noticed that the Spanish possessions in Africa raised the interest of some Hispanists that, you know, were considered like multiple regions at the same time. But other ones, on the other hand, considered that it would be a rival to the attention that Spain ought to pay to Latin America, that it's concentrate. So I'm still doing a lot of archival research, but I'm interested in seeing how Spanish textual production presented Spanish colonialism in this region, and how they negotiated with the economic exploitation that took place in the possessions, in the colonial possessions in Africa, and then how as cultural politics develop in the 20th century, to what extent what has been the peninsular discourse about Latin America was reproduced or was changed and transformed in presenting the African colonies and negotiating and dealing with them.
Well, I'm absolutely positive we at the New Books Network would love to talk to you about that project as it develops, especially given the number of crises and highly charged moments in Spanish history of colonialism in Africa during the same time period that you've outlined here. So I'd be very interested to hear how people made sense of those crises and major events in the mm-hmm. colonies.
Yeah, I mean, it's still, you know, a lot of archival work, so it's still in the process, but hopefully in a few years from now.
Well, I'm excited to learn more about it, and thank you so much for your time and for an excellent book, Diana.
Thank you very much, Ithana. Thank you for such a, for the invitation and for such a careful reading.